5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. Yes, indeedy, Findleedy. Now, if you know where that is and you post about it on social media, I don't know what I'll do, but I'll shout you out in public so you'll know something. Someone will know that you answered this question and that you did a great one right there. That's a nice little trivia to start off the year on The Punch Out, January 4th, 2021. We are back in a new year. Shout out to all our Punch Out listeners. Shout out to everybody who helped us take off in the last year and everyone who's going to be here to help us take off it even further, that sounds right, in the new year. Anyway, shout out to you. Happy New Year. Hope everyone's having a good one. And if not, hopefully we can improve it for you here on The Punch Out. We've got good news for you. Well, some good news, some, I don't know how you want to call it in terms of news, somewhat ambivalent from my point of view. We have Julian Assange getting at least a temporary reprieve. That's the good news. But the first thing we want to go to, which I guess it depends on how you look at it, is the hashtag Force the Vote controversy in the aftermath now that Nancy Pelosi has ascended to be the Speaker of the House in the United States House of Representatives yet again. Hashtag Force the Vote. You may have heard about it. You might have seen it. I guess those are the only two ways you can engage with the hashtag. So you either heard about it or you saw it. It's a hashtag that swept the progressive world over the past few weeks, really since mid-December, all over the holiday season, really right up until this past weekend in the vote or leading up to the vote that ultimately confirmed Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House once again. A lot to be said about this, but let me just say first and foremost, and what I want to get to in the meat of this, I'll catch you up if you don't know what I'm talking about. But what I really want to get to in the meat of this is my biggest takeaway about Force the Vote, the aftermath of Force the Vote, is we're in a situation that the quote-unquote left in the United States often finds itself in. And that is one of confusing tactics for strategy and divorcing the conversation around what tactics to use from what the strategy from where you're trying to go really is. So that is my general take. We're going to get into it. But some people here, and I'd say maybe good for you, have never heard of this hashtag, aren't really following it. I could go either way about that. But if you're not very online, let me catch you up. Towards the end of the year, mid-December-ish, the comedian Jimmy Dore, subsequently joined by Breonna Joy Gray, who, among other things, is the former press tech secretary for Senator Bernie Sanders, that's when he was the presidential candidate, I should say, in this past Democratic presidential primary. Anyway, that's her superlative there. Anyway, they both started to push this idea in mid-December about how to advance the struggle for universal health care, Medicare for all, called many different things, single-payer health care as well. They noted that Nancy Pelosi was working with a tighter majority to be elected House Speaker this time around and needed more or less all the Democrats to vote for her. And that they, as they further noted, this created at least some leverage for House members who claim to be progressive, at least, because they could withhold their vote, which created a touch of chaos for Pelosi. I mean, allegedly, there was no one else running. But realistically here, if it seemed like she couldn't gain the majority, some other person would probably come forward, try to find a way to gain the majority. So it could at least lead to her dethroning, which meant that there was some leverage there. And that for progressive lawmakers, this was a good opportunity to use said leverage, that they should withhold their vote to make Pelosi the Speaker of the House until she agreed to bring a Medicare for All bill to the floor. And that ultimately would make lawmakers declare which side they're on as it concerns Medicare for All in the midst of a pandemic. And certainly I, for one, would not want to be seen as such a ghoul to vote against universal health care in the midst of a pandemic. Obviously, many people would. So at the very least, I would show you some of who people really are, maybe some of who we already know they are. But be that as it may, that was their basic point. Now, that created a huge online firestorm. Certainly on Twitter, I'm not really on the other social media, but I'm just going to assume that it was also there. But I can tell you on Twitter, it was huge. I mean, it got so big that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, who was one of the people who was being pushed around this Force the Vote strategy, actually responded to it on Twitter and responded very negatively to it, quite frankly, as did many other people. They were very against this idea of hashtag Force the Vote. What was their basic point? Well, their opposition more or less boiled down to one issue, which was that the vote will never succeed. It it will be meaningless. And so ultimately, why would you even do this for something that isn't going to lead to a vote that could lead to Medicare for All? That's what they're saying. There was a secondary issue that became a bigger issue as the controversy went on, which was more or less the way some of the forced to vote advocates were pressing their case, which some opponents argued was making other supporters of universal health care the main enemy, not the for-profit insurance industry. So those were the main points of opposition to this for this forced to vote issue. So now you're caught up on what hashtag forced to vote is. If you didn't know, where are we right now? Ultimately, Pelosi was elected. She is the Speaker of the House. Yet again, there was no promised vote. There wasn't one already, and there hasn't been one promised for Medicare for All. So ultimately, there was no vote forced. So after all this hue and cry, what can we say about this moment and its aftermath? Well, first, I just have to say this. I mean, it's just not clear to me why this was all so controversial, quite frankly, on both sides. I mean, it honestly just felt like a massive argument over how to not be that effective. I mean, more or less, both sides of the argument were saying, well, listen, there's no chance that their action or lack of action would actually lead to any major change in terms of getting universal health care or even perhaps move the conversation all that much. No one was suggesting that this was some major turning point for universal health care. So whatever you think about all the different arguments, it seems wild to me that there was almost like a life and death struggle online between people about this tactic when, again, both sides were admitting it wasn't necessarily the world's most pivotal event or action or activity, and it certainly wouldn't pass Medicare for All. It just seemed like a lot of heat and light over what was a relatively small idea. Quite frankly, to me, this all reflects a very unhealthy obsession by quote-unquote progressives, however you want to frame that, with Congress itself, Congress as the main actor. For sure, Congress is where the laws are made, but it's not where the real power is. That's the for-profit healthcare industry, which, by the way, organizes itself, certainly to pressure Congress, but also through a range of pressure groups, fake patient groups, advertisements, bought and paid for scientific studies, and so on and so forth. In other words, they have a strategy for which they use a variety of tactics. The strategy, profit over people. The tactics, all the things I listed before. So if we acknowledge that Congress is the front man, so to speak, don't we also need to realize that Congress isn't our main arena, or at least not yet, and that in fact, pushing them to do anything, or at least the results of pushing them to do anything, is basically dependent on their perception of the ability of those doing the complaining to do something about it after the fact in the next election. So you have to have the power before you can really get them to acknowledge it and do something about it. So again, both sides acknowledge, not there yet, that in fact, in order to get there, it requires a large mass movement, which actually has to still be built. So yet again, it seems hard to reconcile the level of anger and vitriol that was happening during this debate, if you want to call it that, when the actual content being proposed seems relatively unobjectionable, just like pretty much every other thing that's going to happen without much of a chance of success, but that at least stirs the pot a bit, maybe keeps the issue alive, keeps the conversation alive. It just seems totally out of whack to me. But that aside, I think the important thing here is while I think the opponents were angry about this in a way that made no sense to me at all, I think, to be honest, the force to vote, the hashtag force to vote people, I hate to call it like that, like they're just random individuals. So sorry if you're offended there. You're not just a random person. You matter. But the partisans of forced to vote, let's put it like that, seem honestly, quite frankly, wrapped up in the same thing. I mean, look, I get it. I understand it. It's deeply frustrating to see Democrats do basically nothing, certainly without a doubt, use opportunities for leverage in Congress. I mean, it's just astounding. I think anyone who wants to see major change for working class people is often astounded by the Democrats, what the Democrats won't do, as opposed to what they actually do, and are often deeply underwhelmed by what they do. So I hear you. I get it. I do. But what's the point? Now, the stated reason, of course, is that it can be an organizing tool, but for what? I mean, we already have a good sense of who doesn't support Medicare for All. And none of the people who might be exposed as fake supporters of Medicare for All can even be primaried for 2 years here. So this is an issue far in the future here, despite, you know, what was being put forward in terms of what would actually happen, what this would actually show people if you had the vote. So it's unclear to me why in this moment, a focus on Congress doing something they almost certainly won't do, which as everyone admits, won't really move the ball forward, at least not very far, on the issue of Medicare for All for itself. How is that going to inspire the sort of excitement and feeling of possibility that in and of itself inspires people to join struggle? It seems to really be focused on the internal politics of progressive members of Congress and how they act or how they should act, i.e. it's inward focused, not outwardly focused on building a mass movement. And the thing that really makes me say this, quite frankly, and why I view this as the myopia, is the timing of how it came down. While Force the Vote was getting off the ground, the biggest issue in the country was the stimulus, which had not yet been passed. Democrats were inexplicably making a big stand, especially in that last weekend before it was originally passed by Congress, making their big stand about giving more money to the Federal Reserve. A lot can be said about that. Let me not be detained. That was the big Democratic stance. Not increasing the amount of money in direct payments, where Bernie Sanders was trying to make a stand in the Senate basically alone. The only person he had really was this far right idiot, Josh Hawley. So it seems to me, if there was leverage on Pelosi, it should have been to increase the checks from $600 when there was also the leverage of the government shutting down and the military not getting any money, which always moves votes inside of Congress. In that context, it does seem absurd that House progressives didn't seize on the Pelosi vote to make a similar stand. And it should be added, be seen as the people fighting hardest for the working class in this country. That would make sense. That I would understand. The force to vote around Medicare for All, as I was saying earlier, unclear to me about what the connection is between the tactic and the strategy of getting to Medicare for All. That's my biggest really point here. My biggest problem is that the excessive focus on the Congress as the leaders. Congress moves on money and votes. If you can deliver or take away lots of that, you're at least in the game. You're at least in the conversation. Outside of that, you're on the outside looking in. Despite the large percentage of support for Medicare for All, there isn't yet a true mass movement behind it. So the key right now is how to turn supporters into fighters. And there's no magic bullet to make that happen. Tactically, both sides are making important points about the need for building at the grassroots level, the importance of pressuring politicians, sometimes in ways that can be very uncomfortable, certainly for them, and means that your quote-unquote friends have the fire put to their feet there, and that ultimately it's going to take a mass movement of millions of people. However, the discourse doesn't seem to really reflect that complexity at all. It seems to just be about whether this person or this group or whoever has a better strategy for convincing AOC to do something. In fact, the most substantive points of the whole debate seems to have become totally lost in a point-scoring match by the end of it. And at the end of the day, as I said at the top of this, this is a common problem for the left in the United States, the confusion between strategy and tactics. Force the vote is a tactic. One that was divorced from a strategy. A tactic is what you do. A strategy is where you're going. How does the first thing move you down the road towards the second thing? And neither side had a clear answer. The opponents to force the vote just said, oh, well, it's organizing. That's not an answer. That's an evasion. Since technically those pushing force the vote were also organizing. So again, strategy being held captive to debates over tactics. The real question is, what needs to change in order for us to get to Medicare for All? And yes, one of those things is better, more effective, more aggressive representation at all levels of the political process. But there's obviously a lot more to it. When you have an idea that has 70% support in the country or something like that, and almost no support in Congress, it tells you there's a long way to go to motivate and to mobilize and to move people forward. And we have to ask ourselves not, should we force the vote? Should we not force the vote? I think we have to ask ourselves, how do we build that movement? What are the various things that are going to reach people and going to move them at all the various pressure points? What are the connection between those things? And certainly between those things and forcing the vote, which I would include within them. How do we connect the range of tactics to the mass outrage and the obvious need? That is the kind of conversation we need to be having. That's the substance of how we move to Medicare for All. Instead, it seems like there is just 4 weeks or so, maybe it was a little more than that, where you had two sides of people who basically agree and certainly agree on Medicare for All, arguing like they wanted to kill each other over the tactic rather than the strategy to move us from where we are now to where we need to be. Okay, well, we've got some good news to end it off for you here today on The Punch Out, and that is news that to me was very shocking this morning. I think others might have also been very shocked by this. An extradition court in the United Kingdom ruled that the United States would not be granted their request to extradite Julian Assange to come to this country and face a range of charges, mostly around, you know, this quote-unquote issue of espionage. And because of that, this was really a landmark case with broad implications for press freedom around the world as Assange is being prosecuted for the act of doing journalism. There are a range of charges on a numerical level, but they boil down to criminalizing Assange, mainly under the Espionage Act, as I mentioned, for receiving and publishing classified information about the true inner workings of U.S. foreign policy, as well as the corporate world and many other countries, quite frankly. The U.S. and the U.K. had already colluded to keep Assange trapped in the Ecuadorian embassy for years in a de facto form of imprisonment in order to at least attempt to cripple the WikiLeaks publishing infrastructure, which had ripped the veil off of many of the secrets and lies of empire. But that isn't exactly how it happened in terms of, or rather, I should say, that is not exactly how it happened in terms of what they were expecting. WikiLeaks has not actually been taken down. They've continued to publish some of them actually big stories. Last year, they actually rocked the country of Namibia with a major story about the fishing industry. But let me not be detained by that. Nevertheless, they were not able to take out WikiLeaks. They were able to put Assange in a de facto prison, now in a real prison, to potentially extradite him to the United States. But it does seem that the outcry around the world from everyone from the ACLU to former Brazilian President Lula has maybe had some effect here in terms of what is happening in the legal proceedings in the UK, despite the fact that the fix seemed to be in. Obviously, the UK and the US are thick as thieves as it concerns the issue of imperial rule. However, they seem to have been tripped up here by the U.S. system of mass incarceration. Those who were opposing the extradition all over the world are making a huge point here that the prisons in the United States are super brutal and that Julian Assange, because of depression he was suffering and other things, would be in an extreme risk, extreme mental health risk of committing suicide. Now, the judge, who accepted basically every argument made by the United States government for extradition, did, however, note this one issue, the issue of U.S. prisons, and stated that it would be, quote unquote, oppressive to extradite Assange because of his depression. And she noted that the U.S. prisons are so bad, using such brutal solitary confinement, that Assange was almost guaranteed to commit suicide, thus making it improper to send him to the United States. I mean, you talk about unintended consequences there. Well, there it is. Now, there's going to be a bail hearing later this week to determine if Assange can get out while the U.S. is appealing the case. So it's not over yet. The judge had said she was, quote unquote, satisfied with her review of the relevant issues, whether or not U.S. prisons were so bad Assange would be almost guaranteed to kill himself. This was an issue at trial. As I pointed out, his lawyers raised it. It was an issue in the public outcry, a major issue in the public outcry. So it's already been out there. The U.S. has already made representations on this issue. I assume they've made some in private that were very strong to assure her. So it's definitely not clear that Assange will not be extradited in the long term. But given the judge's wording today, given the broader issue of how terrible we know U.S. prisons are, I think it has to be said that the brutality of the U.S. prison system is, ironically enough, really sadly enough, working in Julian Assange's favor so far. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.